are listening to Books Are My People, a bi-weekly podcast for book lovers with book news, book recommendations, and ruminations on living a literary life in Los Angeles. It is officially summer. I can't figure out if it feels like summer or not after 3 months at home. My kids have definitely been staying up later and sleeping in. Like, they slept in. One slept until 11:30 the other day, which has been kind of nice because it means that I get some quiet time to myself in the morning. I've been trying to write or read during those morning hours, which makes each day feel a little bit more productive. Sorry about the dog barking in the background. My kids, I have two boys who are 11 and 14, are not doing any in-person camps. I don't even think that's an option here in Los Angeles. Maybe some beach camps are open. I'm not sure. But my 11-year-old is currently doing a sports franchise online camp. Let me tell you who is not doing a sports franchise camp when they were little. That would be me. So he's doing that right now. Hopefully you won't be able to hear any of it. They're doing their draft picks. I don't even really know what that means. Anyhow, I wanted to share that I did find a host of free 1 hour, 1 week camps from a company called Varsity Tutors that I wanted to share with you. I will put a link in the show notes, but they have camps available for all age groups. I signed them up for a ton, figuring if they miss a day or a week, it's not really any risk because they're all free. And they include topics like science at home, presidential secrets, French for beginners, and brain games. So it's just something for them to do that gives me an hour. And it's been hit or miss. I feel like my youngest didn't have the best, I mean, the teacher wasn't the most engaging person, but my older son did this crazy insect camp, and he knew the host from YouTube. He's like some famous YouTuber who goes out into the wilderness and purposely gets bitten or stung by insects because he wants to experience firsthand what that is like so he can then describe it to his viewers. I've been updating the blog section of my new website with many virtual literary events, so check it out if you're looking for something bookish to do. I got to see my friend Julie Clark speak at Diesel Books here in Santa Monica, virtually, of course, about her new thriller, The Last Flight, which I read and loved and will be talking about next time. And even though it's not the same as actually being physically at an event, they do a pretty great job of making the entire experience feel intimate and informative. I've been going to a lot of virtual literary events. You can check out various upcoming virtual literary events at my website, www.jennifercalieris.com. Or if that's too hard to remember, you can always find my personal website by visiting the description of my podcast at www.booksaremypeople. I am so excited that the author Joanne Hart is here with us today visiting, but up first, it's time for some bookish news. So a few months ago, I talked about the National Emergency Library that was created as a nonprofit in order to give the public access to books. 1.3 million books to be exact. But as an author myself, I thought that this might be controversial, and it turns out I was right because publishers have sued, saying that lending these books without compensation is copyright infringement. Of course, traditional libraries have to pay publishers licensing fees in order to share their books, and even ebooks are paid for in terms of how many listens they get for a specific cost. But the National Emergency Library wasn't participating in this way, and instead was taking books that had been donated and just scanning them through a scanner and then posting the pages online. So to me, it seems like it was a well-intentioned project that was poorly executed. When my oldest son was entering maybe third or fourth grade, he had to read The One and Only Ivan by Catherine Applegate over the summer. It's about Ivan the gorilla, who has spent the last 27 years behind the glass walls of his enclosure in a shopping mall. He then meets Ruby, a baby elephant who was just taken from the wild, and through speaking with Ruby, Ivan is sort of forced to see their home through new eyes. It was just a great book, so I was thrilled to learn that it has been made into a film, voiced by Sam Rockwell and Angelina Jolie, Danny DeVito, Helen Mirren, and Chaka Khan. How cool is that? It will be skipping a theater release and going straight to Disney Plus on August 21st. I have more movie news today. Angie Thomas's young adult novel that really should be read by everyone, titled The Hate U Give, is available for streaming for free on all platforms. I use this novel in my writing the young adult novel that I teach at UCLA. It's about 16-year-old Star who is navigating two different worlds, her poor neighborhood where she lives and her elite prep school that she attends. And everything changes when she witnesses the fatal shooting of her childhood best friend by a police officer. This definitely is a timely novel and a timely movie, and now everyone can watch it for free. Plans are in the works for a museum celebrating the life of author Mary Shelley. I believe the museum will be in the city of Bath in England, and I've been there. It's so, so pretty. The plan would be to convert a 5-story building into Mary Shelley's House of Frankenstein. The museum would be fully immersive and family-friendly. I loved Frankenstein, and I had no idea until I read it way back in graduate school that it's an epistolary novel. I don't know how I missed that for the first 23 years of my life. So one day, when we are all traveling again, I hope I can get to Bath and to the Mary Shelley Museum. And now for our special guest. I am delighted to welcome our guest to the podcast today. Joanne Hart is the author of Stamford 76, a true story of murder, corruption, race, and feminism in the 1970s, published through the University of Iowa Press in 2019. And it is a true crime memoir that weaves together the personal and public threads of a friend's 1976 bow and arrow death. And I had the great pleasure of reading this book in anticipation of Joanne's visit today. She is also the author of Float, published by Ashland Creek Press in 2013, which is a dark comedy, and Addled by Little Brown in 2007, a social satire that intertwines animal rights with the politics of food. Her work, which also includes short fiction, articles, essays, and drama, often explores the relationship between humans and their environments, nature or otherwise. So welcome, Joanne. I'm so happy you are here with us today.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Can you let our listeners know where in the world you are?
Oh, I am here in Gloucester, Massachusetts, where we've been having a drought for many weeks, and we're currently expecting rain, so I'm all excited.
Yay. Oh, summer rain is so nice. We don't get that in Los Angeles, but I have fantasies about it. And just to let people know how we connected, we each have a novel published by Ashland Creek Press. They are publishers who are based in Oregon, and they focus on environmental literature.
Yep, that's right. That's my novel, Float, the dark comedy about plastics in the ocean.
So Stamford is about the murder of a young woman named Margot who was found in Potter's Field with an arrow shot through her heart in Stamford, Connecticut in the mid-70s. And this was a woman you were friends with and spent time together, if I'm getting this right, over the course of a year.
Yes, that's right. And I knew her boyfriend better than I knew her as well. We were both in interracial relationships. And so I'm a white woman. And I was with a black man. And so Howie was a black man. His girlfriend was Margot. So it's Howie and Margot who are who had both been killed. Margot had been murdered by bow and arrow. And then Howie was shot dead by the police.
For readers out there, this all happens on page 4. So these are not spoilers as we're talking about this.
Right. Yeah.
The book feels especially timely in terms of exploring issues of race and privilege, systemic racism, and I'm wondering if you could speak to this.
Oh, yes, I know. My goodness. That's an amazing coincidence that that this movement has started just when my book came out. There are a lot of similarities. between the past 3 years and the 70s. It's like the 70s were blowback to the civil rights era, all the gains made, people of color in the 60s and affirmative action. And all that was great when there was plenty of cake to go around. But then in the 70s, during high levels of unemployment and recession, there was a lot of blowback. It wasn't like the 60s where everybody's all like, you know, kumbaya, interracial couples. We were just hated by both, every group. Today, it's wonderful to see everybody on the streets. Oh my gosh, it just does my old heart so good to see this, because the reckoning of slavery in America has been a long time coming.
Yeah. Well, it was amazing to read it with our current lens, you know, read this story about something that happened a long time ago through our current lens. As a writer who has previously published works of fiction, what made you choose memoir for the story?
It's just because it was a true story. You know, it was a story that I needed to work on, you know, because the death of Margot and Howie had been so traumatic. I'd sort of blocked out a lot of my young self in order to block out those deaths. And so I needed to sort of find myself. So that's not something that is so easily done with fiction. It is, it's a true story. It's the genre, I think, is true crime. True crime memoir, that's this genre. So I grapple throughout the entire book with my memory. You know, what memoir is all about is memory. You know, my memory did not match up to the facts.
Partway through the book, you go to visit your ex-boyfriend Joe's mother, Georgia, and I loved reading everything about her. Every time she came up on the page, she just lit up. And you discover on one of your visits there that Joe had, in fact, written a novel. And I'm curious about how this particular discovery changed or enhanced your book.
I was so excited when she told me that manuscript existed. I had gone to see her on a condolence call. I had found out that Joe had died. And she told me what was in the apartment, you know, that this manuscript was there. And I was so excited because, you know, I'd been working on the book and I thought all my questions were going to be answered in this. And because it was autobiographical from the moment he was born right up until his death. And I was so excited. And then it turned out, it was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, manuscript pages, and he skipped really right over the deaths of both Howie and Margot. And Howie was his best friend, and he barely addressed it, you know, and Margot got a few lines in the book. So, you know, it just also goes to show how traumatized he had been as well. You know, I was traumatized. He was traumatized. You know, we never talked about the deaths after they happened. We moved out of town. And we never talked about it. We did, and so I thought I'd find all these answers. But it was great because the novel gave me his voice, which was wonderful for like doing excerpts and really getting the feel of what it was like to be, you know, a young Black man in the 60s. And he was highly educated. He'd gone to prep school in Darien, and he was at Columbia University in New York.
And he ran for mayor at one point, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Ran for mayor twice in Stanford. So sort of to see his world through his eyes, and then you see everything change.
Well, it's obvious that you did a lot of research to write this book, and I'm wondering what that process was like for you.
Yes. Well, I love research. You become obsessive of researching what you're writing about.
It's also a nice way to procrastinate writing, I find.
It's a wonderful way to procrastinate. So it took 20 years to write this book. I was getting my MFA in writing and literature at Bennington, and started did an essay for George Packer. Out of the blue, remembered like, oh, Howie and Margot. Wow, that was weird. And wrote an essay And then George really encouraged me to stay with it. And I spent 20 years writing it. A lot, days I spent in the basement of the Ferguson Library going through, scrolling through microfiche. And I read every newspaper of the Stanford Advocate, every edition. Sure, I would find the truth about Margot and Howie, and that I just went to, you know, talk to as many people as possible. But of course, many people had died, and most people just wouldn't talk to me about it. You know, no family member, either family member, would talk to me. You know, it was just all too traumatic.
Readers and writers alike love to hear about other writers' routines. So what do your writing days look like since the quarantine began, or regularly, and what are you working on now?
So my writing routine, I have to say I'm a little unfocused during the quarantine. I've been doing a whole lot of other things. It's been hard to use words. So I've actually been playing a lot with photography in the past few months, but I do have a routine, and that is I write in the morning and then work in the garden or the house in the afternoon. And so I get up very early and I write, and I'll write till like noon or 1 o'clock. And just what am I working on now? I'm in like a third of the way through a novel, which is very, now, I guess one of the reasons it's hard to be writing during the COVID thing is because now if my novel's set in contemporary time, now how do I weave that in to the new novel? So I've been a little stymied with that.
It's interesting. Every writer I've spoken with has also had trouble writing during these times. And it's interesting you talk about photography as a visual medium, because personally, I've been focusing more on painting, which is not something I am at all trained to do, but it is creative for me. And it's become really meditative. Like I need to paint every day, and I can't write every day. I don't have the focus. I don't, like you said, I don't have the access to language in a way that I felt like I used to. It's just a bizarre time to be writing.
That's right. That's exactly what's going on with me.
Well, thank you so much for chatting about writing with us. Joanne's going to stick around as we move on to the books. So, Joanne, would you like to share your first recommendation with us?
I would like to do just three quickie recommendations of what we were talking about books to read about race in America. Stamped from the Beginning by Ibram Kendi. Unbelievable history of racism in America. That wonderful thesis too, about you know, the institution came first and then the racism comes afterwards to justify it. And so that's great. One, another book is White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. She is a white woman who does racism in the office, workplace, and things like that. And that book rocks. That's Beacon Press. And the other book I highly recommend, if you'd like to educate yourself more, is Negroland by Margot Jefferson, about exceptionalism. Those are three recommendations I have about the subject matter.
So I'm going to throw it back to you for another pick.
Since this is a podcast about books, people will love The End of Your Life Book Club by Will Schwalbe. That came out a few years ago. It is the world's worst title because it is a memoir of a man and his mother going to cancer treatments and the books they read in the waiting room. And it's like a scrim to go through their relationship, and it's just beautiful. And they, you know, discuss all these books, many of which I went on to read, and how the reading created the two of them. He was a book editor. The End of Your Life Book Club by Will Schwalbe.
That sounds amazing. I love books that recommend other books. That's so much fun. So my first pick for today is Rodham by Curtis Sittenfeld. And I hadn't really read anything of Sittenfeld since she wrote the novel Prep way back in 2005, but she is also the author of 4 additional books, including American Wife, which was popular, but again, I hadn't read that one. So Rodham is in an interesting genre all on its own. It's definitely historical fiction, but it's also speculative because the premise is, what if Hillary Rodham had said no to Bill Clinton's marriage proposal? And I read this novel on the heels of watching the 4-part documentary on Hulu about Hillary, so I was definitely in the Hillary zone and ready to consume this book. Sittenfeld obviously did a ton of research to write this book, and a lot of it traces Hillary Rodham's time at Wellesley and meeting Bill Clinton at Yale Law School. But instead of marrying him, she says, no, thank you. And that's where those sort of speculative sliding doors nature of the novel really takes off. The book begs the question, what happens to brilliant women who are not held back by men? And this alternate history is just fascinating to read. It reminded me a bit of Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, which, if you haven't read it, it explores what might have happened if Charles Lindbergh had won the presidential election in 1940 instead of FDR. Sittenfeld's book feels like a meaty biography, even though it's, of course, fiction. Some places definitely felt slower than others, recounting the history that a lot of people know already, but other places felt very fresh and new when she kind of goes off on her own. And there were some very uncomfortable, squeamish moments, like the romantic scenes between Bill and Hillary. It's hard to read a book about someone you feel like you know so well, and it was hard for my brain to absorb this alternate history. The book gave me a lot to think about in terms of politics and feminism, and I would recommend this book for anyone interested in those topics or interested in Hillary Clinton. And again, that was Rodham by Curtis Sittenfeld. Joanne, what do you have next?
My next recommendation is set in the 1940s. It is All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. So I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, D-O-E-R-R. And this was the most beautiful book. It's a novel, and it is set during World War II in Germany and then France, multiple points of view, including a young boy in Germany who then, you know, is in the German army. And so you get to see how insidious fascism is, you know, that how this like sweet kid who all he is, he's just obsessed with radios and science and the stars and his love of the world, and how he becomes like just a tool and an instrument of the Nazi party, and of course becomes party to atrocities, and how slowly that happens, how insidious that process. But it's also, there's a beautiful love story there. And it's very historical about being in France during that time. And the protagonist is a woman, a young blind woman, who's part of the resistance, although I don't think she knows it for a while. It's just stunningly beautiful. And I'm a real fan of books that incorporate a great deal of science. And that was All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
That is such a beautifully written book. It's just wonderful. And I also love science, and I believe in science, and I love people who believe in science.
Yay!
So go science! My next book is related to science. It's my final pick for today, and it is called The End of October by Lawrence Wright. So I've decided that there are 2 types of readers. One that runs away from all pandemic literature during an actual pandemic, and one that runs towards them. And I am definitely in the camp of just embracing it and running towards all the pandemic literature and movies and whatever I can get my hands on. So if you also run towards learning more about pandemics while we are concurrently in one, then this book is for you. This is a fast-paced novel about a virologist named Henry Parson, who works for the CDC, and he has to go into overdrive when a novel virus, the fictitious Congoli virus, rears its ugly head and works its way first through Indonesia and then Saudi Arabia, and then it's taken over the world. And it's up to Henry to put an end to it. He has a wife, Jill, who's in Atlanta with their family, and Henry, who is supposed to be home in time for his daughter's birthday, keeps postponing his return because he's got to fly all over the world and contain the virus. The book definitely has the pacing of a spy thriller, but my favorite parts weren't the dramatic plot, but rather the places where Wright delves into the history of virology, tracing specific pathogens like the Spanish flu and Ebola, and he walks the readers through what makes certain viruses different and unique and challenging to fight. So very scientific in its approach, and I learned a lot through the research he did for this book. It sent me down a deep rabbit hole searching for interesting nonfiction books on the history of viruses. And like I said at the beginning of the segment, I understand why people might want to run away from these types of stories. But for me, reading this book didn't make me more anxious. It actually made me feel a whole lot better about our current situation because it reminded me that things really could be a lot worse when it comes to pandemic. So again, that's The End of October by Lawrence Wright. Joanne, what is your last pick for us?
This is like a mini pandemic book. It's called Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead by Barbara Comyns, C-O-M-Y-N-S. It was written in the 50s. It is English and it is very English, but it was republished by the Dorothy Project a few years ago, which is an incredible small press. They just published two books a year by women and about women. And so they wanted to resurrect this real gem of a book. But you have to have a certain, strange sense of humor because everybody is just dropping dead in this book. So it's a little bit of a mini mystery, but everybody's also just a little bit deranged. And I love that sort of book. And the family dynamics just steal the show. You have to sort of like Barbara Pym, who also writes like 1950s, like excellent women, just really like calm, beautiful English books about the pastor, and the parish. And Cold Comfort Farm, it's sort of crossed by Stella Gibbons, which is like totally quirky and it's so English and everybody's wacky and we just love them all. And so I highly recommend this because it's sad and it's wacky and it's just a little tiny village pandemic. So it doesn't get beyond that. And it's slim. And as I said, you've got to have a certain sense of humor for this sort of, morbid comedy. But I do have that. So that book was Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead by Barbara Comyns.
That sounds amazing. So it sounds like you are also someone who runs towards the pandemic literature as well. Who wouldn't love a wacky pandemic book? I was sold on that description. So that is all from my end. Thank you so much, Joanne, for stopping by and speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
All of the books and links to purchase these books, including all of Joanne Hart's books, can be found in the show notes of this podcast or at booksaremypeople.com. And if you want to reach out and say hello, please do so at booksaremypeople@gmail.com. Up next for me is Who is Vera Kelly by Rosalie Knecht. And Joanne, what are you going to read next?
Well, I've been reading right through this whole thing, pandemic. I've been reading War and Peace, the literary magazine of Public Space started sort of a group reading of it and been doing 20 pages a day. But here it is the end of June and I'm only halfway through, but it really is a book I've been wanting to read my whole life. So here I am. I'm doing it.
That sounds so fun. So that's all from my end. Thanks for listening and I hope you all have a wonderfully bookish week.